The views and opinions expressed here are those of the guests, and are not the official position of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
One of the most remarkable aspects of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is its unique history. Throughout the world, great stories from faithful church members have only added to that history. This program shares some of these incredible stories of faith, perseverance, hope, and inspiration. You're listening to Legacy. I'm your host, Nathan Wright. Eliza R. Snow and Emmeline B. Wells were preservers of the 1842 through 1844 Nauvoo Relief Society minutes. Eliza Snow, secretary of the Female Relief Society in Nauvoo, largely created the record and then brought it to Utah, where she displayed it and cited it when she addressed Relief Society women. Both Snow and Wells emphasized Joseph Smith's teachings concerning women's spiritual capacity and responsibility and the importance of the women's organization to the completeness of the church organization. In studio today is Jill Mulvey-Durr, Senior Research Historian in Special Projects Division of the Church History Department. Previously, she was the Managing Director of the Joseph Fielding Smith Institute for Latter-day Saint History and Associate Professor of Church History at Brigham Young University. She is past President of the Mormon History Association, and her research and publications have focused on the history of Mormon and Utah women. Welcome, Jill.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Today we'll be discussing mostly these minutes that we introduced briefly. Describe, please, for us this book of minutes that Eliza R. Snow kept.
The minutes of the Female Relief Society of Nauvoo are now housed in the Church History Library of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The volume itself measures about 12.5 by 8¼ inches, and it's slightly over an inch thick. This record is well worn. It's been recovered with black book cloth that's not very handsomely sewn on. But the record itself underneath is a beautifully bound leather book with some gold imprint on the border of the book. And I've loved looking at this book. I have a great sense of reverence for it. It's really clear when Eliza R. Snow herself kept these minutes that she too felt a great sense of reverence and respect for the words and names she was recording therein. It's interesting to me that she's kept taken such care to there are very few crossovers or strikeouts. This is just a very meticulously kept record. She was very careful about the names of members she recorded. If she misspelled a name, she would scrape off the ink with a penknife and write over it again. So this volume contains a record of the meetings of the Female Relief Society in Nauvoo between March of 1842 and March of 1844. It includes the names of members, often their donations. It describes the hymns women sung at their meetings. And most importantly, probably, the core of this record are the sermons that Joseph Smith himself delivered to the Relief Society women between March and August of 1842. Those six sermons are immensely important.
We most often equate Eliza R. Snow not only as a past president of the Relief Society, but a poet. What effect do you think her being a poet had on the meticulous way she kept this record?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I rather suspect that Eliza was elected secretary of the Female Relief Society of Nauvoo in large measure because people knew her reputation as a poet. She had published a lot of poems by this time in the people would have seen them in the Times and Seasons, but previously she'd also published in the Quincy Whig, also an Illinois paper. Actually, her skill as a secretary didn't come from so much from her experience as a poet as her experience as her father's secretary. She grew up in Ohio. The Snows had 7 children, 4 daughters first and then 3 sons. She was the second daughter, and her father was very active in public affairs as a county commissioner and justice of the peace. She served as the secretary in his office for a number of years. That normally would have fallen to a son, but since the sons were so much younger, Eliza took that on. So she did have some experience keeping minutes and serving as a clerk. So I guess a mixture of her work as poet and her experience as secretary came together in this Relief Society work.
Thank you. Something we didn't really know about Eliza R. Snow. This was basically a 2-year record. The Relief Society of Nauvoo was eventually disbanded in 1844. Was it understood that it would be reestablished, or was the existence of Relief Society in question at that point?
The Relief Society was set up originally, of course, to be the Relief Society was set up originally as a means whereby women could collectively assist the poor. But there were other purposes for the Relief Society as well, and we can talk about some of these later. Certainly one of them was to prepare women for the temple, the endowment that they would receive in the temple when it was completed at Nauvoo. Much of the instruction Joseph Smith gave to women, I think, helped them understand that they would be partakers in the blessings of the priesthood. Joseph Smith was introducing many new doctrines in Nauvoo. The temple endowment, the concept of sealing families together and building these connecting bonds, family bonds between people. And of course, one dimension of those connecting bonds was plural marriage. I think it's important to understand the sense that the saints had at this time that people needed to be connected by ordinances, by covenants, in a horizontal kind of way, I guess you could say. In their own generation, they needed to be connected as husbands and wives, as sons and daughters, the living. We think of our temple work as connecting us sort of vertically or back in time. They spread those bonds horizontally, in a sense. And I think that's one way that we can understand plural marriage. Plural marriage, of course, was not publicly taught in Nauvoo for the very reason that it would stir a lot of controversy, both within the church and from outside the church. So what you have, essentially, is Joseph Smith introducing plural marriage privately to his associates in some of his associates in the Quorum of the Twelve and other trusted men, and you also have him introducing it confidentially to women. What happened is in Nauvoo there was a disparity between those who knew about plural marriage because they had been taught it or privately engaged in it in connection with the prophet Joseph Smith, and those who knew about plural marriage only by rumor. And the fact is that the disbanding of the Relief Society is directly related to the controversy over plural marriage. This makes it a little complex to explain. So, as I said, the disbanding of the Relief Society is related directly to the controversy over plural marriage. And that controversy was spawned and exacerbated by the fact that Joseph had taught plural marriage confidentially to a circle of his close associates. And other members of the church and those outside the church in Nauvoo knew about plural marriage only by rumor. And I think the tension in terms of the information that was actually out there about plural marriage caused a lot of controversy. So what we have happening in March of 1844, there are four meetings of the Relief Society called to discuss a document that was written by W.W. Phelps at the invitation of Joseph Smith. This is entitled The Voice of Innocence. And this document was read earlier to the general congregation of Latter-day Saints. The document itself was written in response to accusations of individuals who came to Nauvoo and essentially cast aspersions on the character of Latter-day Saint women in Nauvoo, talked about their loose morals, accused them of prostitution and a lack of virtue. And this document, Voice of Innocence, was written to proclaim the innocence of Latter-day Saint women who were being denigrated by those who came to the city. So it was a defensive measure. The difficulty was that this document essentially says we don't advocate prostitution or spiritual wifery or polygamy or any other form of marriage. So on the outside, it looked like a denunciation of the plural marriages in which a small circle of saints were engaged. To those on the inside, what they're saying is we don't believe in these practices except as authorized by God and priesthood authorities. So the discussion of this document in the Relief Society, where part of the women were among those who knew about and practiced plural marriage and part of the women were not, caused a lot of turmoil. And the turmoil caused in those four Relief Society meetings as women discussed whether or not plural marriage was taking place in Nauvoo and under what auspices exacerbated the tensions that were already erupting in Nauvoo regarding plural marriage. And so Relief Society meetings were stopped. And when you ask, was there an intention to resume them? I don't know that at that time there was any intention to resume them, because the tensions current at that time were so intense that the climate just did not permit for that kind of gathering, at least in the minds of church leaders. So in 1845, Brigham Young explicitly reiterated that he did not want the women meeting again. So I think what we could say is that the disbanding of the Female Relief Society of Nauvoo was directly related to the feeling and emotion around the practice of plural marriage and the different opinions and information people had in terms of whether or not they had been personally taught that doctrine by Joseph Smith or they were only learning about it by rumor. It was a very difficult situation, and it's also complicated further by the fact that people didn't talk about it until nearly 40 years after the fact. So whatever happened there must have been immensely difficult. The minutes themselves tell us very little about what went on at those meetings. We do see Emma Smith in the minutes of the final meeting telling women that they should follow the direction of church leaders from the stand. In other words, what they're publicly teaching rather than what they're privately teaching. So that gives us a sense of the tension that existed.
Very interesting. Thank you.
More than you wanted to know, I'm sure.
But we know through the teachings of the Prophet Joseph that Relief Society was inspired. We know that it was part of the Restoration. Can you give us a little background of perhaps Relief Society, so to say, in the ancient church?
It's interesting to look at Joseph's sermons to the Relief Society and see how he was trying to assist women in understanding the spiritual and eternal nature of the organization. The women who first promoted the idea of putting together a women's organization or a women's society patterned their organization after the organizations that were so popular in the United States at that time. There were lots of benevolent societies and sewing societies and missionary societies and praying societies. And this is certainly what they envisioned for themselves when they got together and had Eliza R. Snow write a constitution and bylaws, which she then presented to Joseph Smith. His response was, tell the sisters that the Lord has something better for them. And so when Joseph Smith assembled the women on March 17th in 1842, he wanted to instruct them in what he had for them that was beyond the worldly kind of organization they had imagined. So first of all, he set them up with a presidency that paralleled really the presidencies of priesthood quorums. It was a president and two counselors. And he told them that they should elect other officers as they saw fit. This term elect had a special significance with respect to Emma Smith, who was elected, or we would probably say sustained, but they use the term elected, as president of this first Relief Society. As she assumed that position, what Joseph taught the sisters is that she was fulfilling the revelation given in 1830, now known to us as Section 25, wherein she was called an elect lady. At that first meeting, as the minutes record, President Smith, meaning Joseph Smith, read the revelation to Emma Smith from the Book of Doctrine and Covenants, which, as I've indicated, is now Section 25. So he read the revelation to Emma Smith from the Book of Doctrine and Covenants and stated that she was ordained at the time the revelation was given to expound the scriptures to all and to teach the female part of the community, and that not she alone but others may attain to the same blessings. The second epistle of John, first verse, was then read to show that respect was there had to the same thing, and that why she was called an elect lady is because elected to preside. So it was Joseph Smith himself who indicated that in the second epistle of John, the first verse, which is addressed to the elect lady, he's tying Emma's calling to expound the scriptures and teach the female part of the community to that elect lady in the New Testament, and implying that where he said respect was there had to the same thing, that a similar organization existed in the primitive church. That's not something that a lot of New Testament scholars have latched onto, or the way that many people would interpret that term elect lady. But that is the way that Joseph Smith saw it. And Eliza R. Snow, as she helped with the reestablishment of the Relief Society in Utah, drew upon this reference from Joseph to tie the Relief Society even more explicitly to the ancient church. Let me just say, prior to saying how Eliza R. Snow used this concept taught by Joseph Smith, that she played a very special role in the re-establishment or the reinstitution of the Relief Society in Utah. As we've noted, the society was disbanded in 1844, and though women met together and certainly assisted the poor as they made the westward trek and began their early years in Utah, they did not meet under the auspices of the Relief Society. In about 1854, when Brigham Young called women to assist the Indians in Utah Territory who were in need, women of their own volition formed little groups that they called Indian Relief Societies because they were specifically formed to do the sewing and put together the provisions that would provide relief to needy Indians. This movement spread in the 1850s. We had numerous relief societies. Brigham Young suggested that they be under the direction of their ward bishops. So we did, from about 1854 to 1858, have numerous ward relief societies. The difference was they did not have any central direction, and they probably were patched together as best women could from their own knowledge of the Relief Society in Nauvoo. These functioned until about the time of the Utah War in 1858, and particularly the move south, the move of people from the Salt Lake Valley and other northern settlements south when the federal troops marched into Utah at the end of the Utah War. Now, that move was very disruptive, and one of the casualties was certainly the relief societies. Some of them continued, but basically we could say that brief relief society movement kind of dissipated and the societies pretty much disappeared until 1868, when there was a lot of emphasis on immigration, and Brigham Young hoped that the sisters could organize once again to aid the poor. He started by calling upon the bishops to organize relief societies in their local wards. Some of the bishops responded, others did not. He made that initial call in December of 67, and then again in April of 1868 in General Conference, he called for the relief societies to be reestablished. And at this point, he asked Eliza R. Snow, who was one of his plural wives, to work with the local bishops in organizing the relief society. And she did a couple of things. One, she wrote a very important article that appeared in the Deseret News, and I'm going to talk about its contents in just a moment. And secondly, she went personally from ward to ward and helped set up this organization of a president and two counselors. She often read from the minute book itself, read the minutes of the first meeting to express what Joseph Smith's hopes had been for the Relief Society and to instruct the sisters from that minute book. It is in her article for the Deseret News that's simply entitled Relief Society that she references Joseph Smith's this concept that Joseph Smith articulated, that there was something similar in the primitive church. And this is how she states it. The first two paragraphs of her article in the Deseret News define an organization of substance, significance, and authority. Under the simple headline, Relief Society, she wrote, This is the name of a society which was organized in Nauvoo on the 17th of March, 1842, by President Joseph Smith, assisted by Elders Willard Richards and John Taylor. Although the name may be of modern date, the institution is of ancient origin. We were told by our martyred prophet that the same organization existed in the church anciently, allusions to which are made in some of the epistles recorded in the New Testament, making use of the title Elect Lady. And as we mentioned, that's in the second epistle of John, the first chapter. So I think it's very interesting what she's doing here. By tying a women's organization, or what she actually terms in this article, a quorum, to the ancient church, she essentially took it out of time, or made it timeless, and provided continuity. And this was a way of clearly avoiding the difficult and complex history of starts and stops in Nauvoo and Utah that I've just talked about. She sort of made this seamless by essentially saying to the sisters a little addendum to the sixth article of faith. You know, we believe in the same organization that existed in the primitive church, and it also included something for women. And I think this gave them a powerful sense of connection. It meant for them Relief Society didn't come out of nowhere, that it's a very important part of the Church of Christ. And this she emphasized, writing in her second paragraph in the Deseret News article, "This is an organization that cannot exist without the priesthood, from the fact that it derives all its authority and influence from that source. When the priesthood was taken from the earth, this institution, as well as every other appendage to the true order of the Church of Jesus Christ on the earth, became extinct and had never been restored until the time above." So this woman is a remarkable thinker, and in addition to her great spiritual gifts, I think she had a capacity to articulate concepts that would quickly and powerfully tie women to this organization. I think it is inconceivable for church members today, male or female, to conceive of the church without an organization for women. We take it so much for granted. But if we take ourselves back to 1868, we have to think of the church where women sung in the choir and perhaps taught Sunday school. They certainly would have aided their neighbors in a neighborly way and participated in temple ordinances. But that was the extent of their contribution besides attending sacrament meeting. So Eliza R. Snow and those who worked with her, and she had many sisters who worked carefully with her on this, are really stepping forward to make a major, major change at this moment in time, and setting a clear doctrinal and historical foundation for this is extremely important.
So based on this connection she was making with the ancient church, she seemed very adamant that the Relief Society be connected with the priesthood. Now, it seems when a person or organization is out to prove themselves, so to speak, to accomplish something, it seems like they want to do it on their own. They're like, I don't need help from anybody, see what I did. But why then did Eliza R. Snow feel this connection with the priesthood would help legitimize the organization?
This is a moment of time in American history when, as I mentioned, from the early part of the 19th century forward, we have lots of separate women's organizations. And in fact, about this time, following the Civil War, we really have a whole new thrust of women's organizations, women's clubs. The missionary societies, the sewing societies, praying societies, the women's clubs are all very much run by women, financed by women, and a way for women to participate in the public sphere. I think it was clear to Eliza Snow, and she was very close to Brigham Young, lived in his household, and was a trusted advisor to him, especially on women's issues. I think it was very clear that there was not going to be an organization in the church that was autonomous. So Eliza R. Snow, as she goes on to describe the Relief Society, talks about it being self-governing under the direction of the priesthood. Now, that may seem inconsistent in to many people, but for her, there wasn't an inconsistency in that. And I don't think for women generally there was inconsistency, because they had their presidencies who were entitled to revelation for the work that would go forward in a particular ward. They had the precedent set by the Female Relief Society of Nauvoo, but they clearly were not going to move outside of the approval and counsel of bishops and later of stake presidents. This is the period of the 1860s, late 1860s, early 1870s, when relief societies are founded on a ward level. Starting in 1877, we get a stake relief society organization, and the general presidency comes later in 1880. So very much starts on the ward level, and these sisters are under the direction of their bishops, as everybody in a ward is under that authority. Now, that's not to say that there weren't conflicts over jurisdiction and authority, because those certainly did come into play. But I think as Eliza and her sisters spoke with Brigham Young and other church leaders about this organization moving forward in a new generation, and I mean, let's be clear, this is a new generation. This is 24 years after the Female Relief Society of Nauvoo. I think there is this clarity that women have authority, but it does not supersede the authority of their priesthood leaders. And that's the order that is everywhere in the church. A bishop is under the direction of his stake president, and the stake president under the direction of general authorities. That doesn't mean they don't have responsibilities and act somewhat autonomously, but that order is very much there. And I think that Eliza R. Snow and others recognized that the effectiveness of the Relief Society was going to be contingent on that. I want to say two things in that regard. One, we have a comment from Mary Isabella Horn in about 1871, 1872, who was working with a local relief society. And it's interesting to me what she says, which is something like, as if she has her fingers crossed, "We've been organized now for 3 years, and there's been no need to interrupt our organization or stop our service." And I think you can see women remembered what it was like to have the kind of controversy and tension that made it impossible to have a functional organization. So they weren't about to go in that direction, and they were proud of themselves for being able to work harmoniously with their leaders. In the 15th Ward in Salt Lake, where Sarah M. Kimball is the president and Bishop Burton is the bishop, we have a great partnership of a bishop and a Relief Society president. And Bishop Burton later reflects, as the work of this ward is going forward in such marvelous ways, that there's never been the least jar between Sister Kimball and himself. Now, I have to say that's remarkable. This isn't a group of sisters who sat around and did nothing or waited for the bishop to give them advice. This was probably the most activist relief society in the valley. And that is really the second point I wanted to underscore, that because these women worked under the direction of the priesthood does not imply in any way that they were passive. They were so eager. They were such faithful stewards. They took care of the poor in their wards. They accumulated excess funds. They built Relief Society halls. They began cooperatives. They sponsored obstetrical training for women and established a hospital, established a newspaper. They were so active in the community. These were women who were so excited to have the responsibility, have the opportunity to have responsibility, that they were very careful and prayerful stewards. And this period from 1868 to till the end of the century is just a period of magnificent awakening as they begin to really figure out what this organization Joseph Smith introduced can do for them and for the church as a whole.
Along that vein, there was a quote, maybe even more of a story, of the women of the Relief Society moving quicker than their priesthood brethren, and someone saying, I don't know if it was Eliza R. Snow, let them hurry and catch up if they need to.
Yes.
Can you quote that for me?
As I've mentioned, Eliza R. Snow underscored the importance of women working within the prescribed order of the church. The society stands in the same relation to the bishop as the society in Nauvoo did to Joseph Smith and must always act in accordance with his instructions, she told women in Provo. Nor were the women to burden the bishops, but rather to assist them in caring for the poor. Snow expected women to take initiative and assert autonomy within Relief Society's proper sphere. We need not be afraid of doing too much nor getting ahead of our brethren, and if we did, why let them hurry up, she told women when she spoke to them in Sandaquin. She taught women in Gunnison the same principle, drawing precedent from the Nauvoo Minutes. The prophet Joseph Smith said to the sisters, provoke the brethren to good works.
So does this quote show cooperation with the priesthood sprinkled with tolerance, perhaps?
Yes. One of the things that Eliza R. Snow later wrote to a Stake Relief Society president was, we must honor the priesthood even if it is in earthen vessels.
Very good. Eliza R. Snow also taught one of the purposes of the Relief Society is not just to relieve the suffering of the poor, and perhaps that may even be a very small part of it, but to save souls. And I wonder if that is the souls within the Relief Society and the people they're serving. What do you have? What's your take on that particular quote or concept, actually?
Yes. Joseph Smith told the sisters in June of 1842 that the purpose of the Relief Society was not only to relieve the poor, but to save souls. I think he was very clear with women that they had a responsibility to save themselves, that their first spiritual responsibility was really to take care of their own personal salvation. He was very clear that once he had given them instructions, he told them this in April of 1842, that they would be responsible for saving themselves. This was an important concept for Eliza R. Snow, and she repeated this on numerous occasions, indicating that many women had thought that their husbands would save them or that the brethren would save them. And she made it very clear that this was not so. We have responsibility for saving ourselves, she told them, and this is what Joseph Smith taught the sisters. Beyond that, of course, she saw the work of the Relief Society as the work of salvation, that individual sisters worked toward their own salvation, but they also had a responsibility for working toward the salvation of others. this has to do with helping people temporally, of course, and spiritually. Eliza had a lot to say about the work of visiting teachers and reaching out to people in need and warming them. She taught constantly about the importance of understanding the doctrines of salvation and performing the ordinances of salvation. I think this the emphasis on ordinances had particular importance for her because she presided over women's ordinance work in the endowment house and worked there herself 3 or 4 times a week and believed with all her heart in the importance and efficacy of that ordinance work. So yes, she taught women that they must be about the work of salvation. And that was something she had learned from Joseph Smith personally and felt he had also delivered that instruction to the Relief Society.
So was it the passing of Eliza R. Snow that put the book into Emmeline B. Wells' hands? Or why did Emmeline start using the minutes?
Emmeline and Eliza were close associates in the work of the Relief Society. Emmeline was almost a generation younger than Eliza, but as Eliza traveled, and I should underscore here that she traveled the whole territory, often took the minutes with her instructed sisters at length between 1868 and her death in 1887. And as she traveled, she often took other Relief Society associates with her. Emmeline is one of those who traveled with her frequently. Emmeline Wells became the editor of the Woman's Exponent in 1877, the woman's paper that I mentioned. She worked closely with Eliza, who was part of the consulting committee or board of editors for the Exponent. And she traveled with her. She sometimes performed secretarial assistance for her. So the two women were very close. I am not sure that the minutes moved directly from Eliza's hands into Emmeline's hands. It appears that another woman who served as secretary to the Relief Society General Presidency at this time, Romania Pratt Penrose, is the one who had charge of the minutes following Eliza's death. Following Eliza's death, Zina D.H. Young became president of the Relief Society. Zina and Eliza had traveled together constantly. They were very close, both of them plural wives of Brigham Young, both of them associated at the in the Lion House and certainly in their Relief Society work. Like Eliza, Zina Young presided over women's temple ordinance work. In the case of Zina, she presided over women's work in the Salt Lake Temple because the temple was built by that time and dedicated. She used the minutes, we know, as a course of study for the temple workers in the Salt Lake Temple. So Zina seems to have had the minutes in her possession for a time. Emmeline worked very closely with Zina, maybe even more closely with Zina than with Eliza. And we assume that sometime after Eliza's death, although we can't be for certain, Emmeline made her own copy of the minutes. She copied that minute book word for word, and that handwritten copy is now in special collections at Brigham Young University, the L. Tom Perry Special Collections. So Emmeline had her own copy of the minutes probably in the late 1880s, early 1890s, and drew upon them frequently, published excerpts from the minutes pretty regularly in the Woman's Exponent, the paper that came out semi-monthly.
Emmeline is quoted as teaching that Relief Society will help women's emancipation from error, superstition, and darkness, etc., will bring educational and economic opportunities to women. Where did she come up with these particular concepts? Was it the minutes or was it something more along women's rights?
That is an interesting question. I think we see in that question that these minutes have been used differently over time, just as we might, in our own study of the scriptures, for example, pull out different concepts at different times, depending on what we need as we teach leaders or teach our families. The women did much the same thing. Joseph Smith's sermons to the sisters cover a great many topics, and Eliza R. Snow, as we indicated, wanted to focus on the connection of the Relief Society to the organization of the church, both in modern times and in primitive times, focus on the Relief Society's important work in salvation. Emmeline Wells, as I mentioned earlier, was a generation younger than Eliza R. Snow. And she came of age in a very different generation, a different moment in time. By the time she is copying the minutes in the late 1880s or early 1890s, we have a Relief Society organization that, in fact, has been operating now for 20 years without stop. Not only that, the Relief Society sisters had been instrumental in establishing the Young Women's Organization beginning in 1870, and also the primary organization beginning in 1878. So in that first decade after the reestablishment of the Relief Society, we have all these new responsibilities for women emerging. Actually, the organization as we experience it today in the church was pretty well in place in terms of women by 1878. So Emmeline, as she's looking at these minutes, is not trying to legitimize women's work in the church in the same way that Eliza did, because that's already been legitimized. And she is, as you suggest, tying into a much broader movement for women's rights that's well underway at this time. Mormon women actually had received the vote, been enfranchised in February of 1870. Then they went through some difficult times as the government enacted anti-polygamy legislation, which threatened and finally did eliminate women's suffrage in Utah, which that in 1887, which women then had to fight for again. And by 1896, when Utah had a constitution, women's suffrage was again included, partly because of the work of Emmeline B. Wells and others who worked so hard for women's suffrage and other aspects of women's rights. Now, Emmeline herself had a very different personal history than Eliza. Eliza was 38 when she became a plural wife of Joseph Smith, 42 when she became a plural wife of Brigham Young. Her own life as a single woman, much of her life had provided her opportunities for public achievement through her poetry that she certainly carried out in the last half of her life, or the last portion of her life, as she assumed these leadership responsibilities. Emmeline's life looked very different. She married, I believe, at the age of 15 and moved to Nauvoo, had a baby at 16, That same year, her husband deserted her. She was left alone, became a plural wife of Newell K. Whitney, and had with him two daughters. Newell K. Whitney died, and she married Daniel H. Wells and had another three daughters. So she was a mother of five daughters, a woman who'd had to make her own living part of the time, had certainly suffered reverses, and I think was much more concerned about giving women rights than had been the case with Eliza. So yes, she came at these minutes and the sermons of Joseph Smith quite differently than Eliza had. And for Emmeline, it was the 28th of April sermon that Joseph Smith gave that really had the most powerful meaning for her. And let me quote now the words of that sermon. On the 28th of April, Joseph Smith gave a magnificent sermon to the Sisters of the Relief Society. In his own diary, he recorded that he had given them, he had addressed them regarding the priesthood and the way that the sisters could come into the privileges and blessings of the priesthood. So this is probably the most remarkable of all of Joseph Smith's sermons, and it's not remarkable that Emmeline would have studied it with particular care. Toward the end of this sermon, he says, Joseph Smith, "This society is to get instruction through the order which God has established, through the medium of those appointed to lead. And I now turn the key to you in the name of God, and this society shall rejoice, and knowledge and intelligence shall flow down from this time. This is the beginning of better days to this society." That was a statement that Emmeline and others found particularly meaningful. Emmeline, as she looked around her in the late 1870s, 80s, and 90s, saw that women's position in society was changing in a lot of ways. Certainly it had changed for Mormon women. They had the possibility of voting. They were sending sisters to medical school. They had established a hospital and a newspaper. Her own life, she had seen change markedly over time. In the 1820s and 1830s, the laws in the United States were so prescriptive with respect to women who could not own property, could not vote. These are the very restrictions that the movement for women's rights was opposing and protesting. It was interesting for Emmeline, I think, and others, as they became involved in the movement for women's rights, which they did. Mormon women became members of the National Women's Suffrage Association and later the National and American Women's Suffrage Association. They were charter members of the National and International Councils of Women, formed in 1891-92. So as they became active in these societies, they, with other women, looked at the way the history of women's rights had developed over a half century. So Emmeline and others looking back could see that the initial convention at Seneca Falls in New York had taken place in 1848. And in her mind, she thought, well, look at that. That declaration of women's sentiments, that memorable gathering for women's rights, actually took place after the organization of the Relief Society, because the Relief Society was organized in 1842. So as she looked at these minutes and as she looked at Joseph's sermons, she came to believe that when he turned the key, that gesture, I now turn the key to you, and the pronouncement of the beginning of better days applied not only to women in the church whose lives had certainly changed over that half century, but to women in the United States and perhaps in the world as well, that all kinds of opportunities for women opened up in the 19th century. In fact, it was known as the woman's century. Women's lives changed during that period of time, and Emmeline celebrated that and felt that Joseph Smith, as a prophet of God, had initiated a new era for women by turning the key.
So it's evident that both Eliza and Emmeline used the minutes not just as a history, but rather a constitution, what they were trying to accomplish with Relief Society. Now, is that what Joseph Smith said would happen with those minutes?
Joseph Smith actually said at the first meeting that the minutes should serve as a constitution and law, that they should be precedents to act on. And I think those who held these minutes took that very literally. Eliza kept those minutes in her possession. Emmeline made a copy of the minutes. We know that the minutes passed after Zina Young, certainly to Bathsheba W. Smith, who was her successor as Relief Society president. Susie Young Gates, who was very close to Zina Young and became active in the Relief Society, made her own copy of the minutes. Amy Brown Lyman, as general secretary of the Relief Society at the early part of the 20th century, retyped the minutes into the bound volumes of general board minutes. So I think that we see a continuing emphasis on the importance of these minutes. Emmeline published excerpts from the minutes, particularly Joseph's sermons, repeatedly. When she became editor of the Relief Society magazine, which succeeded the Woman's Exponent, Susie Young Gates did the same thing, published Joseph's sermons. These were foundational. These were part of Relief Society beginnings and women's constitution. The Relief Society didn't come from thin air. It had these instructions from a prophet and these valuable minutes that serve even today as its foundation and beginning. We still have a Relief Society president with counselors and other officers as required. We still go forward in the work of charity. We still have a great deal to do with helping women work toward their personal salvation and the salvation of their families and promoting the work of the church through the world. So today, these precious records continue to have importance for women and for the church worldwide.
I don't know that the word scripture has ever been used in association with the Nauvoo Relief Society minutes, but Eliza and a whole line of Relief Society presidents have used them in such a way that it almost, you know, appears to be that they've, like a publication, like a modern publication of the Ensign, Words of the Prophets, it seems like they've used them that way.
They certainly did. And I think it's worth noting that these words of the prophet to the women had and continue to have a special place in women's hearts because they were directed to them by a prophet of God. And they felt a great responsibility to save and preserve them. And Eliza and Emmeline and other women have done that so that they could come down to us today.
Are there plans or have the minutes been published in any form, print or online or anything?
As we've mentioned, these minutes, certainly the sermons of Joseph Smith appeared in the Woman's Exponent and in the Relief Society magazine. They've also been quoted at length in two histories of the Relief Society, the 1966 history of Relief Society and the 1992 history, Women of Covenant, the story of Relief Society. Both of those quote generously from the minutes. The importance of these to women today and the clear importance of Joseph Smith's sermons to women worldwide in today's church has underscored for the Church History Department the importance of making these minutes available. And we're hoping to make that happen in the near future.
That would be an exciting publication to finally be able to see those. I understand you have a publication of your own coming out about Eliza R. Snow's poetry. Is that true?
Yes. For many years, I have been working with Karen Lynn Davidson on assembling and annotating the poetry of Eliza R. Snow. So we are working with BYU Press and hoping that that volume will be out this fall. It includes over 500 poems by Eliza, both published and unpublished, and provides, they're presented chronologically, and we've tried to provide some historical context for each poem, and we're excited about that.
One, just for my interest, is there some historical context of the "O My Father" poem with the prophet's key of knowledge statement in the first Relief Society meeting, or whichever meeting that was?
Oh, that's an interesting question. "Oh, My Father" does speak of the key of knowledge. The Relief Society statement speaks more generally of a key, turning a key. I don't know that there is a particular relationship between those two, because Joseph spoke so often of keys. That is hard to say. The background, actually, for "Oh, My Father" follows the martyrdom of Joseph Smith. Eliza R. Snow was sealed to him as a plural wife in June of 1842. And had great affection for him, great loyalty to him as the prophet. And we know that she had many conversations with him about his understanding of eternal truths. She both listened to his sermons and had private conversations with him. And Eliza was fascinated by the whole plan of salvation, and especially the possibility for men and women to become as the gods and have eternal increase. Many of her poems actually address that truth that Joseph taught. And she spoke to her Relief Society sisters about the possibility of becoming fit companions of the gods and the holy ones. This is something that was of great importance to her. She wrote "Oh, My Father" in October of 1845. It was just after the death of her own father, shortly after the death of her own father. And she may well have been thinking about her own mortality following Joseph's death and the death of her father. But I think that the poem certainly captures those wonderful doctrines that Joseph was teaching in Nauvoo. I don't think she could have left a more magnificent tribute to Joseph than to capture that sweep from the premortal existence through mortality to life in the hereafter in the presence of heavenly parents, with the possibility for men and women becoming themselves parents to preside over their families eternally.
Thank you very much. We have been visiting today with Jill Mulvey-Durr, Senior Research Historian in the Special Projects Division of the Church History Department, and discussing the Nauvoo Relief Society Minutes. And we want to thank you very, very much for being here with us today.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to Legacy. I'm Nathan Wright.